Our next guest on the program is Chief National Correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, best-selling author of books like This Town, Citizens of the Green Room, and his new book, a tremendous read, entitled Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. Mark Leibovich joins us. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Rich, it's good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
I love the book, and I especially appreciate the tone of the book. So many books on the National Football League read like the audiobook would have to be narrated by John Facenda. This has got a very different feel, and I appreciate the way you approach the NFL.
Well, thank you. I that was sort of my intent. I don't, I think a lot of there's been a lot of sort of drama around the league and how it's been marketed and how it's been covered over the years. And I'm an outsider. I cover national politics for the New York Times. And so this is kind of a little safari for me. And I was not encumbered by having to be part of the club. So I do think, I think football is a great game, but I think it's a great game in spite of a lot of the people who own and run the sport. So I think that's more reflected.
Now, you wrote about Washington, D.C. in This Town, now the NFL. Which one, from your perspective, is the bigger swamp?
It's a great question. I would say that it's all kind of the same swamp. And I would say, look, I mean, there's a lot of wealth, there's a lot of age, there's a lot of ego, there's a lot of insularity, there's a lot of, I would say, I mean, self-importance involved. The one big difference between the two swamps between Washington people in Washington need to run for re-election. And I think, I would love to some of these owners and maybe Roger Goodell up for a four-year re-election and see how they fare. I'm guessing they might not do as well.
Have you ever been around a more curious group of people, and you describe it so well, than these owners who, well, my goodness, they're just a unique group, to say the least.
Yeah, they're quite a bunch. I mean, so one of the big surprises for me and one of the big revelations for me in going into this project was just the level of incredible power that these billionaires have over our entertainment lives, both as owners of the biggest rated institution we have in America. I mean, football accounts for 77 of the top 100 most watched events, not just sporting events, but all events in America last year. And so with that comes a lot of leverage, a lot of power, and a lot of wealth. So what was interesting to me was how really smaller than life this group was compared to the disproportionate amount of power they seem to wield. I mean, this is not a group that you would, for the most part, pick to, like, run some of the biggest companies in the world. Or, for that matter, Roger Goodell wouldn't be your first choice, or certainly my first choice, to be the CEO of Apple or Federal Express or Bank of America or something. So, this is sort of a dive into that swamp, and I certainly think it's like a big sitcom and some just real colorful characters. Everyone from Jerry Jones in Dallas to Mark Davis in Oakland to Robert Kraft in Foxborough. It just went on and on. So yeah, I'm almost, I wouldn't say I'm nostalgic for it now that I'm back in politics, but it was a much more sort of cinematographic ride than I expected.
And I love that they live by the credo, only the paranoid survive.
Yeah, I mean, that's a credo you hear a lot around NFL headquarters on Park Avenue in New York, and it's sort of stolen from Intel. Andy Grove, one of the founders or one of the sort of legendary CEOs of Intel out in Silicon Valley, that was his mantra. But one of the differences is Andy Grove and Intel, it was sort of a call to vigilance. It was like always be working, look around the next corner. In the NFL, I sort of took the term as more kind of a sign of fear or more a sign of, yes, the golden goose might be as fat as ever, but you just never know it's going to come and just sort of end it really quickly, whether it's the Ray Rice thing or the national anthem protest or concussions or what have you. So, with all this prosperity in the league, I found a constant mingling with precariousness and just a nervousness that the chandelier could just fall at any minute.
We're talking with Mark Leibovich about his wonderful book, Big Game. Roger Goodell, it seems from the book that he's great at half of his job, the half that requires him to keep these owners happy and glad hand and treat the older owners especially like mentors, but not so good at avoiding scandal, which seems to follow him wherever he goes.
Yeah, I mean, the other piece of his catering to the owners or his bosses is making them rich. I mean, his number one job is to make billions of dollars for these billionaires who are already, you know, set for life, and you know, many generations down, and their families are set for life. But what he has, you know, especially over the last 5 or 6 years, shown an incredible ability to do is to self-inflict all kinds of problems on the league, turn all kinds of molehills into mountains, and really just have no ability whatsoever to anticipate crises, to sort of speak on behalf of the league in a compelling way. And, like, this is one of the most despised figures in all of sports. I mean, his approval ratings are probably in the 20s. I don't think he would get reelected, but the only voters that count, in his estimation, are the 32 owners that have just signed him to a new 5-year, $200 million contract. So, you know, he didn't go anywhere, but it is really kind of a bottom-line game when it comes to your owners being very, very wealthy and somewhat single-minded.
One of the most curious stories in the book is what's referred to as the cold pizza story. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked me about the cold pizza story. Yes. wow, what a great question. So after Ray Rice incident, which Ray Rice, a star running back for the Baltimore Ravens, was caught on film that was leaked to TMZ, sort of hawking his fiance in an elevator. It was a really gruesome thing. There's a big scandal around how much the league knew. Initially, Goodell sort of slapped Ray Rice on the wrist and suspension, but once that video became public, it was obviously a big to-do, and there was talk that Goodell would have to resign and so forth. So in order to try to get out in front of this public relations crisis, they basically worked with a Wall Street Journal reporter to really show how serious Roger Goodell is about curbing domestic violence and all the meetings he had. And there's this detail that got picked up on a lot, which they ordered in for pizza, but no one around the table ate the pizza until Roger Goodell would. And Roger Goodell did not touch the pizza, so the pizza went cold. So that became known as the cold pizza story, both in the annals of NFL public relations, but also media sort of enabling of the NFL. But the subtext of this, and I found out because I'm such an intrepid reporter, is that Roger Goodell does not like cheese. The reason being, according to my sources, and these are important sources, so I will not reveal them, but the sources being that he had a bad experience biting into a cellophane-covered piece of individually wrapped American cheese back as a child, and it soiled him on, soured him on cheese for life. So apparently that's one of the many demons that is affecting the way he runs the National Football League.
I love that story. Now, I feel like you forged a pretty good connection with a woman that I worked with a little bit when she was a news reporter up here in Maine, Roger Goodell's wife, Jane Skinner, who's a lot more fun.
Jane.
I did. Not well, but a little bit. But clearly, she's much more fun to be around than Roger.
Yes, totally agree. No, I mean, there was a time we were at the first owners meeting I went to in Florida. I had had a little bit to drink, and Jane Goodell, I met her, and I asked her somewhat sarcastically, actually not somewhat, entirely sarcastically, what is the most ostentatious rendering of the NFL shield, which is the corporate logo, that the commissioner makes you display around your estate? And she immediately said, well, there's the tattoo on his chest. And I thought this was pretty funny, and I immediately told her, hey, I'm using that in my book. And she said, no, you're not. That was off the record. And I said, nope, I'm using it. She goes, well, I guess if it's on the record, I should tell you about the tattoo on his ass. I don't know if you can say that on the radio.
Yeah, we just did.
Were people listening, but I think we just did. So apologies to anyone who just offended. But anyway, that was an important revelation. I went to fact check that with the commissioner himself. He assured me that he did not have any tattoos anywhere on his body, and he was very serious about this. So I would say this is a he said, she said case about the tattoos.
When your book is made into a film, I expect it will be a buddy picture. I can't wait to hear how they score it musically for your opportunities to hang out with your BFF, Tom Brady.
You know what? If you have any ideas for musical scores, I'm all for it. No, Tom and I are great friends. We're very alike. You can't see me because this is radio, but we look exactly alike. We're both married to super models, and both have a lot of money. Both great quarterbacks. Unfortunately, I'm 53 and 5'8", so don't have the tools that he has right now. But no, Tom is someone who, one of the many sort of unlikely people who, in the course of writing this book and reporting this book, I got to know. And originally, he was a subject of mine for the New York Times Magazine, and we kept in touch over the years. And, you know, the thing about writing Big Game was that it was sort of a sampling of getting to know league officials like the commissioner, a lot of the owners, and players like Tom, who, I mean, I think are part of this ensemble, but also they're these, you know, they're royalty in their markets, obviously, but also, I don't know, I found him to be oddly innocent and oddly, I guess I'd say, you know, just sort of fairly simple in some ways. I mean, I enjoyed hanging out with him, and I'm sure he's thinking 24/7 about how great it was to hang out with me.
Well, no question about that. My impression of Bob Kraft in the book is a bit of a sad figure in some ways. When you talk about how long he cried about losing his wife and how often he talked about that with you, and is this sort of strange competition he has with Jerry Jones. And I found it all a little sad.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, look, Robert Kraft, who, you know, had tremendous success with the Patriots, he lost his wife about 7 years ago. I mean, they were married 50-plus years, and obviously, you know, how can you not have empathy for that? And he's quite open about how terrible, you know, that experience has been and how lonely he is. But at the same time, he's also 77 years old now, and like many NFL owners, is frequently seen in the company of much younger women. And I think he's a bit of a politician in that he does tend to tell the same stories over and over again and isn't sort of fully cognizant of the fact that he's not the smooth sort of public figure that he might think he is. But look, he's had immense success. I root for the Patriots, so I'm grateful for that. And he, like, you know, you'd expect, he very much wants to be in the NFL Hall of Fame. Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, is in the NFL Hall of Fame. So he's jealous of Jerry Jones' Hall of Fame status. Jerry is jealous because Robert has 5 rings to his 3, and this is the kind of thing that billionaires worry about.
Is Belichick, and you said you committed this as a Patriots fan, is he perhaps the least interesting of that triumvirate?
Oh, I think the most interesting, perhaps. I mean, I didn't really push, I mean, admittedly, I didn't really push the ball forward very much there because, unlike Brady and Kraft, I didn't really spend any time with him at all. There is, I guess, a very good book out right now. I haven't read it yet, but, you know, Connor, called Belichick, that I think, you know, he doesn't talk to Belichick either, but he gets a lot of new and I think relevant, and it sounds like very interesting information. But no, I mean, I think he's the best coach of certainly his era, if not all eras. And, you know, there's a lot of mystery around him that I think some people might mistake as arrogance. And, you know, I might be one of those people at times, but he is, you know, I'm glad he's the coach of the team I root for and hope he goes on for a while.
One of the towering figures in the book, as well he is in our daily life, is Donald Trump. We talked to Jeff Perlman a couple of weeks ago about his book on the USFL and how Trump pretty much screwed that whole enterprise up. It seems like Trump versus the NFL is just really the reality show of our times.
It really is. I mean, this is like the twin spectacles of American life, and Donald Trump gets to be in the middle of both of them. And I think one of the interesting things about the last 2 or 3 weeks is the NFL has actually had a relatively peaceful couple of weeks, and perhaps because the president has been preoccupied with things like Brett Kavanaugh and hasn't had time to tweet about the NFL and the national anthem protest, which I'm sure the NFL is more than pleased with. So, I mean, the NFL is a club that Donald Trump has not been able to join. He's made many efforts to buy teams over the years, and I guess it's the ultimate consolation prize. He gets to heckle from the bully pulpit in the White House.
Whether it's Deflategate or any of the other little mini scandals, have all of them provided a useful distraction from the concussion issue?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in some ways, we sort of look to football as an escape. And I think, I don't think they're smart enough to figure out that, hey, why don't we put up this offseason's reality show will be about deflating football. Because, often they're much less harmless topics, like, you know, domestic violence or concussions, things like that. So, I mean, the thing about the NFL is I think fans do want to sort of revert their attention back to the field. And if they can use football as an escape outlet from their daily lives and also the more important or more tiresome elements of their daily lives, things like politics, political debate, the NFL is there for them.
The question is often asked, have we reached peak football? What's the worst enemy of the National Football League? Is it Is it concussions? Is it, as Mark Cuban suggested, overexposure? Oh, and will the league survive in spite of the people in charge?
That's the great question. I mean, I think it's sort of the central question. I do think concussions and health and safety in general is probably existential issue one. And it's the kind of thing that sort of bleeds into all other issues. I mean, I think in addition to the very real impact that this game played by increasingly fast and big and strong players is going to do to human or mortal human bodies is an ongoing challenge. You can make some corrections at the margins around rule changes or equipment changes, things like that. But ultimately, it's not a safe game, and that's not going to change anytime soon. And that bleeds into things like insurance and things like liability and things like some kind of government regulation that could really make a huge, huge dent in the ability of people to watch and play and do business as a football entity. So, look, I mean, the worst comparison the NFL, like, the comparison that they just read is a comparison to tobacco, which was such a part of daily life. Mm. It literally was, part of the air we breathe, right? And all of a sudden, people are saying tobacco and cigarette smoking was going to be around forever. It was behemoth, and they were too powerful and too pervasive in life. And then there were all these concerns and studies about how unsafe it was and how unhealthy it was. And then all of a sudden, some laws came down and all kinds of studies came down. And next thing you have smoking being a far less significant part of the American experience as it is today. And, football lives in fear of something similar happening.
All right, Mark, our crack research team and our producer, Kerry, have come up with this. I think this would go well in the scene where you're in the locker room, the room filled with the Ryans, as you put it, and you cross over to talk to Tom Brady at his locker. Here's the music we've chosen for that scene in the film.
Okay.
All right, here we go.
People, let me tell you about my best friend. He's a warm-hearted person who loved me till the end. People, let me tell you about me so much.
The courtship of Eddie's father, right?
Exactly, Harry Nilsson. Yes.
Now, so was that actually? I was like 5 years old then. But was that actually a pop song or something you could hear independent of that, or was that a score written specifically for The Courtship of Eddie's Father?
It was written for the TV show, but Nilsson released it on an album. I don't think it was ever a single, though. Yeah.
Wow. I take it as a great compliment and a great honor to be associated with that song in any way.
Well, we absolutely love the book. We're so glad you took a 4-year diversion into the world of football, because a big game, the NFL in dangerous times, is an absolutely wonderful read. And so glad we got to talk with you about it this afternoon.
Rich, this is fun. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. Mark Leibovich with us here on Downtown.